21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. 'Cause under love is a stronger emotion.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, Megan Bowen, our producer. Noah Dankner runs our board. And a special thank you to Michaela Helwich, Media Relations Associate for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You can find them at www.leap.cc. And as they say clearly on their website, quote, history has shown that drug prohibition reduces neither use nor abuse. After a rapist is arrested, there are fewer rapes. After a drug dealer is arrested, however, neither the supply nor the demand for drugs is seriously changed. The arrest merely creates a job opening for an endless stream of drug entrepreneurs who will take huge risks for the sake of the enormous profits created by prohibition. Join us now with David Brown, a former prosecutor of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for his participation in LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a really wonderful organization, and all of you are just so expert at what you know from your experience. So let's first talk about your experience as a prosecutor, what you saw as a result of the drug war and the work you were required to do.
Well, firsthand, I saw our courtroom filled each morning with individuals who weren't able to afford defense counsel. And so that was discouraging because, you know, that's what you need first and foremost to fare well in the court system is an attorney that's going to be a zealous advocate in your defense. And so many of the individuals, as I looked out across the courtroom, were lacking that essential component. And so oftentimes you saw poor people and predominantly people of color in our courtroom each day that were entering guilty pleas. And if you've ever known someone who was charged with a criminal offense or had the misfortune of being charged yourself, you know that your advice from your attorney is always going to be on your arraignment day to enter a plea of not guilty. And then, you know, that sets up an opportunity for your attorney to negotiate, a plea agreement and start working with the prosecutor or the assistant district attorney to get a better deal for you. And so when you don't have that, the full weight of the law slams against you and people end up spending time in jail for nonviolent offenses. And that's not just offensive, but depressing on a daily basis.
And it is a race war, or one should say at least a socioeconomic war, but it is. I know that there's an African-American or a dark-skinned male is more likely to be arrested 7 to 8 times more than a Caucasian male. And we certainly see, as you point out, in our prison system that the poorer the community or the darker the skin, the more likely they're going to fill the prisons. So when you as a prosecutor started seeing this pattern, what did you do? I mean, was there anything you could do as a prosecutor to change what happened in your courtroom?
Well, sure. I mean, there are things that you can do. Prosecutors have a lot of latitude in bringing the cases before a judge. And, our prosecutors are sensitive to what's happening in the courtrooms. In Baton Rouge, although we do have our courtrooms filled a lot of times, and I'm speaking principally about city court. That's where I spent most of my time, and as a prosecutor, that's where I was working as a city prosecutor. But, you know, we also have district court, and it plays out similarly there. But our prosecutors are sensitive to you know, the dynamic that I just described and do their best to be fair. And, you know, it doesn't always work out, and you know, that latitude and that prosecutorial discretion, as it's called, cuts both ways. But in terms of, you know, your specific question about what I did, I had the good fortune of not having to prosecute any drug cases, and I wouldn't have done that just because I'm constitutionally averse to doing that. I've known about this disparity, and sentencing and incarceration for a long time now. You know, I've been paying attention to the war on drugs for a couple of decades, and so I wasn't caught in any sort of moral dilemma myself, but I just had conversations with other prosecutors that did do those cases in city court. You know, and I know that they were all sensitive to it and tried not to, you know, throw the book at the defendants. And it really came down more or less and less to the prosecutors and more to specific judges. And certain judges were really just a lot harsher than others were.
But as you pointed out, the constitutional reality is that if there's no injury to another person or their property, it's as if no crime has been committed. I mean, drug use is actually a constitutionally protected right. Let's talk a little bit about medical marijuana, because I know that's an area you're working on in the South. It seems to be a way to start bringing the public to the forefront of this discussion, because it is the public, in fact, that has paid the price, both in terms of taxation and imprisonment, for this extraordinarily profitable drug war for the states, county, and federal government.
Well, yes, in Louisiana, we've been working on medical marijuana reform as a subset of drug law reform for several years now. And in fact, Louisiana was one of the first four states in 1978 that passed a therapeutic marijuana legislation, and then came back in 1991 to amend it and add an additional condition or disease state, which at that time was spastic quadriplegia. And then did nothing, failed to promulgate sufficient rules to set up a system for our state all the way until now. And so for the last 2 years, you know, we've been fighting hard to create a medical marijuana system in our state. And as you mentioned, that is a starting point for reform. We also have been working on sentencing reform for a long time in Louisiana as well, and this marked the first year that Louisiana passed a medical marijuana bill in 24 years, so essentially a quarter century. And we also set the pendulum swing back in the opposite direction on sentencing, so that we can go a little bit more lightly, though it's not decriminalization. We're working towards that. And I think that, you know, medical marijuana starts by providing medicine for a lot of patients who need it in our state, but it also helps to begin educating our legislators that cannabis is more than just a drug, and that we can pull it from the dark side of just this perception among our elected officials of, you know, just always getting tougher on drugs, and that marijuana, you know, drugs bad, you know, that's just essentially as far as it goes in their analysis. And we're starting to get, you know, we got a lot of legislators, a majority of legislators this year, to acknowledge at least that marijuana works as medicine. And that's I think, a very big start.
Well, and as I've pointed out in the many decades I've covered this issue, we're not a nation that says just say no to drugs. We are a drug nation, a Prozac nation, a Ritalin nation, a whatever nation. So the pharmaceutical drug industry is altering minds all the time with horrible results, creating young boys in particular who go on killing sprees because they're in maniacal response to the drug, and that doesn't get addressed. I mean, the truth is, it's not about health. The drug war has never been about health, even when they said it was about health. And I think it's about control of the populations in the world and the destabilization of our society, so that there is a militarization of authority. And I hate to say it that way, but that's how I see it.
Well, I think you've summed it up well, and there are a lot of different ways to say it. And I've been reading a book just recently about the war on drugs, and, you know, and how it all started, and, you know, Nixon's first efforts, and to criminalize marijuana, and you know, his own commission said that marijuana should not be illegal. And so you really have to question the motive there of the president, who just kept fighting against it when, at the time, not only the public didn't see a big problem with it across the nation, but his own chosen staffers that were leading the war on drugs.
When we look at the damage it's done to our society, to multiracial relations, to socioeconomic development, to schools, building schools rather than prisons, to helping people with addictions, you know, to actually guiding people who do need some sort of help other than, as we've been shown by other people from LEAP, the use of synthetic drugs now that fill the streets. I mean, what are some of the solutions that you see? I mean, what are the steps? We have a lot of people in the listening audience who may, until this very moment, have thought, oh, yeah, I'm all for the war on drugs, without realizing that we now have 1 in 100 Americans in prison. 50% of them are in there for nonviolent offenses. That's our, you know, friends, relatives, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, children, fathers, mothers. For what? For a mind-altering substance that might be self-medicalization or just because they feel good, and there's less damage done from marijuana use than alcohol use, and we know that statistically.
Dr. Hieronymus, I wish I had the answer for you. I don't. I have some thoughts on it, and I think that one of the many things that we can do is state by state, you know, come out of hiding, so to speak, and be vocal about our outrage over what's happening in our courtrooms every day. You know, an entire day in Baton Rouge City Court is given over to the prosecution of nonviolent drug offense. So, you know, we're spending resources that for a while now, I wasn't clear on this, and that's one of the things that as a prosecutor I learned, that, you know, every hour that our prosecutors are spending working on a drug law offense is an hour that we can't be spending working on more violent offenses. And that was conjecture in my mind, 10 years ago. And it seemed like a reasonable argument, but one that I didn't know how to back up. And when I began working as a prosecutor and as a lawyer, defending individuals from drug law offenses, I saw that, and it bothers me, and I hope that it bothers a lot of your listeners, that our prosecutors and our police officers and our judges are tied up with a lot of time and resources working on something that many of us don't even see as a problem. But it's all very clear to us that someone breaking into our house on just a property crime, or even a more violent offense like a rape or a murder, is a problem. And you know, we've got to start by getting vocal on all of it. We can talk as much as we can in the media. We can talk to our friends around the dinner table. I mean, it may not seem like polite conversation, but the only way that things like this are ever going to change is if more and more of us speak out.
Right, because the drug war has, in fact, created a war, and we now have war in our cities between young kids who are vying for control of a corner or whatever, and on an average day in the United States, guns are used to kill more than 80 people, injure almost 300 more, and commit approximately 3,000 crimes. Listen to this. Since John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, I included this in my piece to the Baltimore Sun on the drug war tragedies. More Americans have been shot and killed on our own soil in the drug war than in all the 20th century wars combined. Meaning, since 1963, more Americans have been shot and killed in the drug war than all of our servicemen and women enlisted in every foreign war we've fought.
Wow.
It's a wow. I mean, when you really start to look at the profile of the destruction being wrought for profit. So I keep asking, how do we get the incentive profit out of the drug war and show that if it's a regulated trade and taxed, that there's far more profit and much greater peace and much greater health worldwide?
You know, I sense that Louisiana is an outlier among the 50 states in the sense that there is a profit motive everywhere across the nation, but in Louisiana, we have this added disincentive for law enforcement to begin changing their minds because we have this prison complex. We have this private and public system of prisons wherein our sheriffs are actually profiting from higher incarceration rates. And so when our prisons are full, the sheriffs are happy. when they're not, they're losing money, and we've overbuilt our prisons in the state of Louisiana. And so in this fight, in this struggle in Louisiana, our coalition recognized many years ago that the last men standing essentially were going to be the district attorneys and the Sheriff's Association, and very likely the Sheriff's Association. But I think part of what's happened is that they see the writing on the walls, and this year, through a lot of compromise in ways that we weren't really happy with because we didn't end up with bills that were nearly as strong as we wanted or that were initially drafted, we ended up not having to fight the sheriffs and the DAs at the end. At least we didn't have to fight the sheriffs on medical marijuana, and we didn't have to fight the sheriffs and DAs when it came to sentencing reform, because I think that they see what's happening around the nation. And so that momentum helped us here. But what can we do? I mean, we can speak out against it. We can make it a campaign. We can make it a campaign issue wherever possible. We can get involved with organizations like in our state would be LEAP or Simple. Our organization is Sensible Marijuana Policy for Louisiana. And our coalition is working to make sure that our elected officials hear from us, and if they're not right on this issue, we've got to make it hurt. We've got to, you know, elect someone else in the next cycle, because I think that's the only way that things really start to change. I still believe in that political process.
When I was talking earlier to Jim Gearock, he was saying that when he ran for office, they wouldn't let him on any of the debates because he wanted to talk about the drug war and ending it. And that oftentimes men and women who do choose to run for office, when they do want to talk about this issue, they are excluded from the debates because the media and the government is not interested in ending the drug war. There's too much profit incentive. So again, it's not about public health. It's not about societal welfare. It's really about exploiting the individual for profit. And somehow or other, people have got to encourage the media, I think, by calling talk shows, by writing newspapers, by calling TV stations and saying, what about some honest coverage of this issue?
That's right. That's right. And I believe it. I mean, I'm happy to have lived long enough to see what's happening now. You know, we're getting closer on the national level than we've ever been. You know, we've gotten, by getting the momentum of you know, 24 states now in D.C. on medical marijuana, or all of the states that are taxing and regulating it like alcohol, those four states in D.C., you start to see this sea change, and eventually I think the federal government has to respond. And one of the other things that I was thinking about recently was just that you have commercial interests like GW Pharmaceuticals that's pushing to have, I guess it's Sativex, but one of their drugs, they want to get FDA approval. And the only way that that happens is, of course, for the drug to be rescheduled from marijuana, that is, to be rescheduled from 1 to Schedule 2. And I think if you have a large commercial pharmaceutical interest like that pushing them against the backdrop of all this reform across the nation, then that certainly helps as well.
So we're at the beginning of a change after decades of destruction and a great loss of human life, because there's, as I pointed out, to think that we have more men and women who have killed each other or been killed, whether they're killed by law enforcement or DEA or each other in the fight for control of a drug territory, than all of our soldiers. There's another issue, though, around the militarization of the drug war, which concerns me. I saw that 25% of enlistees return to the states and go into policing, and they are not trained in law enforcement. They are trained to kill. It's a very big difference, which is why I say this is a war, and there's no mistake about it. You do run for your life because you don't know if you're going to survive an encounter with any member of any law enforcement. And it's not to blame the law enforcers. It's to blame our entire society's failure in addressing what is sovereignty, what is freedom, what is liberty, what is health.
That's another alarming point. You know, I was living in Austin, Texas, when I believe the individual's name was Ezekiel Hernandez. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, a little bit.
He was the first individual that was killed by military on U.S. soil in the drug war. And I think in history, I mean, at least that's as I recall. It's been so long since I looked at that story, but he was essentially just on the Texas-Mexico border, and he was a sheep herder. there was a military platoon, or I'm not sure how many soldiers there were out there actually, but they saw him, and he had a rifle just like you would, you know, if you're trying to protect your flock against, you know, coyotes, and they shot him on the spot and killed him. And I mean, it's things like that that are just alarming. The militarization of the police has just skyrocketed since that, you know, I don't know how long ago that was, 20 years ago or so.
Right.
But all the things you mentioned are very worrisome. We have this direct system of, I guess, decommissioning or transferring used military equipment over to our police forces across the country. And then, you know, we have so many military officers coming back and then joining police squads. It couldn't happen at a better time if we actually are ending this war on drugs.
And when we look at all of the men and women in prison whose families have been destroyed, particularly those who have committed no violent crime or offense against any other person or their property, do you think that as a prosecutor, other prosecutors will say it's time to empty the prisons of nonviolent offenders?
I don't know that. I know that in Baton Rouge, for example, I have a meeting this very Tuesday, and one of the individuals that's called this meeting is my former boss, and she was the city prosecutor for all of Baton Rouge, and she's no longer in that position and so has become very vocal about doing just that. I mean, she's including marijuana, simple marijuana possession, along with other things like soliciting a prostitute or urinating in public and a handful of other offenses for which we currently have jail time. And she just got sick of it. And that wasn't a conversation that she and I could have had while I was working for her. But it's very rewarding and reassuring to me to see that we're having our district attorney at that meeting on Tuesday, as well as a former city prosecutor, myself, two professors from the university, the chief of police, and some others, a couple of judges. And we have a city councilwoman who's going to propose some measure of decriminalization on simple possession, and that is going to help if that passes. And I think we're going to have the votes. We have to do some grassroots work for sure to accompany that effort. But if that passes, then we're going to do our part in helping to empty the jails of some of the nonviolent offenders in our city. And I hope that's happening across the country. I think it is.
We hope so. I mean, as some of your former guests from LEAP pointed out, you know, we're spending all this money building prisons and we don't have enough for school books or for athletics or for arts or for, you know, after school training or for summer programming, for rec centers. I mean, just to socioeconomic development in the neighborhoods that have been most plagued by the drug war. I want to thank you so much, David, for the work you do, for speaking out in Louisiana, for being a member of LEAP, and for really taking the time to be with us tonight. Follow up with David Brown and all the others we've talked to so far at www.leap.cc.